History through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, presented on the air and online by Provident Payments, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are stories there that should not go untold. What we've learned is that they don't need to go untold. As long as somebody, and maybe that's you, is willing to take a little initiative and then employ the patience to listen as long buried memories return to the surface again. We want to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice. We want to preserve their stories so we never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And in the process, not only are we educated, not only are we entertained, but so often we end up inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. I expect that to be the case again today in Prunedale, California, with 95-year-old Joe Pintacura. We're going to hear how Joe and his three older brothers all served in the Navy during World War II, but let's start off with the early years growing up in Chicago, Illinois.
I come from a big family. I had three older brothers and two older sisters. I was the last one on the list. So everything that they liked, I wound up liking. My brothers liked baseball, swimming, football, and so I ended up whining just like them. And when they went into the Navy, they all went into the Navy, so I had to go in the Navy too.
And before that, you know, I've heard a lot of stories from people your age and older who lived through the Great Depression and how different those days were. How did you and your family experience the Great Depression?
Well, I know my parents had a hard time. My older brother went into the Conservation Corps in order to, you know, save one more mouth to feed at home. They were on relief. I can remember the relief truck coming and dropping off a great big box of beans and flour and sometimes, you know, fresh fruit. And it was always like, what did we get, you know, that type of excitement. And I know their house was almost foreclosed on because some of the furniture was repossessed. And they really had a tough time. I was home by myself when the furniture guys came, and I let them in. I was little. And they started to take furniture out, and just happened my mom came about that time and stopped them. And then she also, I know they made a deal with the banks to pay off the house over. You know, they changed the payments and stuff. They really had a tough time. My brother Sam at the time, he was the next one down from my brother Tony. He had a job like a paper route, that type of thing. My sisters, my oldest one, I didn't know her as well at the time because she got married to get out of the household. But as far as I was concerned, I was the baby. There was no suffering for me. Everybody took care of me. Yeah, the depression didn't hurt me one bit.
Because that does sound like a lot of mouths to feed, but you guys always had enough to eat?
Yes, always had enough to eat. And the strangest meals, you know, like warm milk with bread in it, and I loved it. Sometimes just fruit, whenever we got a hold of it. I didn't know any different. It was just great. They were a wonderful family. I was spoiled so rotten that sometimes they got angry at me for wanting this and wanting that, you know. So, yeah, it was a great life. The depression was tough on them, but easy on me.
And how did you get along with all those siblings?
You know, we're really a tight family. There wasn't a Sunday that went by that we weren't all together. And even when my sisters started getting married and their husbands wound up in our home. In fact, when I was dating my sweetheart, Shirley, I said, we just have to go to my house every Sunday. It's a must. We don't have any choice.
What would the typical meal be on a Sunday there?
Oh, I've always had pasta of some kind and ravioli, meatloaf, and lots of it. And my mother used to always, when she made the gravy or the pasta sauce, she used to make us keep separate so that we could dip homemade bread in it. And it was just great, yeah.
You're making me hungry, Joe. And what about, you know, to be a boy in those years, what kinds of things kept you busy outside the house? What were you up to?
Well, until I started finding friends through school, you know, the early grades, there was not much, but when they started getting into 7th and 8th grade, you know, then I start palling around with a number of guys from the area neighborhood. And we used to hang out at the school playground. You know, Chicago, we have the heavy, hard winters. All the school grounds where they play baseball, they flood that. So it freezes. And then we ice skate there. And so between playing ball and ice skating, and there was always lots of activities. And my buddies were like I was when December 7th hit. They were just like, what, a war? You know, that was just, couldn't believe it.
Well, and before I get into that with you, I'm interested too, because I think, did you tell me you were really close to Wrigley Field where you grew up?
Yeah, really close. And I used to get free passes for the ball game from those players. And there was Dizzy Dean, and they were all a ton of the well-known ones in those days. And I used to think nothing of it, meeting them, shaking hands, going to games. And they used to practice a couple of blocks away from Wrigley Field at an elementary school. And, of course, everybody was there watching them play. And any of the kids would chase foul balls because they would knock them out of the elementary school park all the time. It was great. Chicago Cubs were, that was my hero team, you know.
Well, and I'm thinking, too, you were a little bit on the young side, but this is still the era, too, where Al Capone kind of ruled Chicago, right?
Yeah, I remember being afraid because I heard stories like he drove down the street with his machine gun sticking out the car door windows and shooting houses as they went by. And I was saying, don't come down my street. Please don't come down my street. Yeah, there was a lot of that gangster stuff. And my parents always said, whatever you do, don't go down on the south side. Always stay on the north side of Chicago, because that's where all the bad guys are, on the south side. And that was my little savior part of it. I figured he's not going to drive down Racine Avenue, where I lived. And he's going to be shooting those people out on the south side.
Do you remember, Joe, having a dream when you were a boy, some hope or ambition of, hey, when I grow up, here's what I'm going to do with myself, with my life?
I had all kinds of those ambitions. You know, I was going to be a pilot. I was going to be a ship captain. Whatever I saw in the movies, and I was liked it, I wanted to be. And John Wayne, we played cowboys. I wanted to go out west and become a cowboy. Yep, I had all those dreams. Never had anything pertinent, you know, like say, that's what I really want to be. Like my brother Roy, he wanted to be an artist, and he pursued that. He turned out to be a terrific artist. And eventually got his own business in commercial art. Yep, those. My oldest brother was a mechanic, but I didn't have any desire to be a mechanic because every time I tried to do something, the wrench would hit my hand. Or the first time I tried to change the tire, I was so angry because I couldn't do it. I had to get some help.
And had your parents both come to America from Italy?
Yes, both came from Sicily. My dad came first because he had some brothers, my uncles, and that were already here in Chicago. So they kind of sponsored him so he could get here. And then he got my mom and my oldest sister. She was born in Italy too. They always had us, the kids, to try to speak English in the house so that they would learn. And that's how they got to be pretty smart too.
Could you understand Italian too?
At that time, I was really good at understanding Italian. In fact, I used to speak it. Now I hardly speak it. And I still understand quite a bit of it. I came home speaking English so to make them happy. And I wanted to learn English too, because when I was little, all I did was speak Italian.
Did your family encounter any kind of prejudice or bias, discrimination against Italian Americans?
No, not that I know of. And I never heard my brothers or sisters saying, you know, there's a problem of some kind. I think we always felt comfortable living on the north side of Chicago. My father had a job at Florshine Shoe Company, so that, you know, it's pretty America. My sister Jane could do hair dressing, you know, and so people would come to the house and she would do their hair for them. Hairdresser.
Did she cut yours too?
Yeah. Everybody was wonderful. My brothers and my sisters, the only arguments we had is when she was sweeping or something and I'd walk in and right across it, you know, can't you see I'm sweeping? Can't you tell I'm sweeping? And you walk right across it. Those type of things.
I know a lot of siblings are nodding their heads. They've had the same scenario. And you mentioned already December 7th, 1941. But if I'm doing the math, you would have been a 15-year-old when that happened. What do you remember about that day?
I remember I was in the house. And there was people yelling outside. It was like Sunday morning. And people in the streets were yelling at them. Sometimes, you know, when they have newspapers, they'll have extra. They'll be selling them, yelling extra. But this was people across the street. They had their windows open, and they were yelling out, we're at war, we're at war. So I went out on our front porch. I couldn't hardly grasp it. So what I did is I headed over to my buddies that lived about five blocks away. And when I got over there, it was the same scenario. People were yelling. My buddies were all outside, and we were trying to get more information. And that's when I first heard about Pearl Harbor, and I didn't know where Pearl Harbor was. It was crazy. Then everything was hectic from that time on. Everybody who couldn't join wanted to join. Everybody who could join actually did go join. Yeah, it was exciting for a number of days there. And then when we heard, well, you can see newsreels in the movie theaters, you know, we went to the theaters to see what we could see. And the newspapers had, you know, pictures of Pearl Harbor. Then we got to hear, I think it was the next day or shortly after, a speech over the radio by Franklin Delano Roosevelt, and talked about this day will go down in infamy. It made it sound like there was a dirty, low-handed, terrible thing to do to us, because they had some ambassadors in Washington at the time that were representing goodwill. And here, knowing that they're going to bomb, at the same time talking sweet talk, yeah, everybody was angry. You know, and the other thing that turned out to be a wrong move that really bothered us later when we start to wake up is when they put all these innocent Japanese, and they didn't call them concentration camps. They just gathered them up and putting them in Utah and all those faraway places from the coast. And then we found out many of their sons went into service, fought for America. Many of the parents kept repeating over and over again, hey, we're on your side. We'll do whatever you want. And it's just a shame, I guess, in the panic, many things can go wrong, and they did.
Yeah, where you live now here in Prunedale, California, that happened to a lot of Japanese Americans around this area. And I've actually interviewed Italian Americans from this area, too, who were pulled in off the coastline because of the concern of that loyalty with Italy being on Germany's side in the war. So you said all four of you Pinacura boys went in the Navy. So who was first? Who was the first one in?
My oldest brother, Tony, was the first one to go in. It was either that or he got drafted, and he didn't want to go in the Army. Fortunately for him, he got stationed in the States. He never did go overseas. And then when my brother Sam was going to be drafted, he joined the Navy too. And he wound up below the equator in the New Hebrides Islands. But he was a mechanic also, and he could work on a lot of the airplanes that would go down there for repairs and stuff. Then my brother Roy, I'm not sure whether it had anything to do with the draft in his case. I think because my two older brothers, then he wanted to go in the Navy too. And I kind of thought, well, you know, I'm not going to break tradition. I'll go in the Navy too. But my mom and dad, who really didn't want me to go in because I was the last one, have to thank my sweetheart Shirley, because I was going to go in the minute I turned 18, which would have been July 19. And because I fell in love with this sweetheart, I didn't want to leave her. So I was fighting the battle of should I enlist now or wait, and I dragged that out until February of 1944. 43 is when I met her, and then February of 44, I went in. So I was home 6 months longer. And in any case, my parents were really happy with her keeping me home.
Well, we've got to hear the story of how you met, because you two would spend the rest of your lives together. So what were the circumstances of your meeting Shirley, and what do you remember about that first impression she made on you?
I had a job at a factory that was not too far from our house. It was in the summertime. They only had students come in the summertime, young people. And we used to do what's a little piecework. And the more you did, the more money you would make. In those days, if you were on an hourly pay, it would be like 40 cents an hour. But anyhow, I had been there one summer, and then the following summer I went back, and when I went back, there she was applying for the job. And I was standing in line right near her, and I says, hey, I can give you some pointers because I worked there last year. So I told her what I thought, and I told her the guy she's going to talk to is a really great guy, and I thought I did a heck of a good job. And they did hire her. So the next day, when she came to work at the lunch break, I went, because they put her in a different floor, so I didn't see her. But she went out for lunch because it was hot in Chicago. Everybody goes outside to eat. So I see her sitting on a railing, and I run over there, and I sit next to her, and I says, so I got you the job, huh? And she says, you know what? You're conceited. And I said, well, what does that mean? She says, you know, you think a lot about yourself. You're bragging. And, well, you know, as far as I'm concerned, you could just go get lost. And I says, wait a minute. I said, I'm really a nice guy. I really am. Let me prove it to you. She says, no, just go sit over somewhere else. So I did. I had to. But then when she was going back in, I opened the door for her. And then she's going out, I run down and opened the door for her. And pretty soon she let me sit with her. And Then one day I said, how about going to the movies? She said, yeah. And that was it. From that time on, we just stuck together like glue. It was great.
So I guess, you know, there's one question that you can't really answer, but I'm sure you have an opinion about or an idea. So if you hadn't met Shirley and you had gotten your parents to sign for you and gone in 43 like you thought, what do you think would have happened to you? How different would your life have been?
Oh, my. I can't even imagine. When she came into my life, it was just two. We were just two. There was no more one. I don't know what I would have done. In fact, after I joined, I was kicking myself. I said, now you can't see her. And, you know, I got in boot camp and I'm with all these guys, and that just made me angry. That I blamed myself. And she was such a sweetheart. When I got on the train, after I got out of Great Lakes training station, I told her we're all going on the train to South Carolina, Charleston, South Carolina. And I'll be darned if she wasn't at that train station. Yeah, we got the hug and kiss. Goodbye. She was wonderful. And always was her whole life.
I imagine you must have gotten a few letters from her aboard ship, too.
Oh, my God, yeah. She wrote every day. And I tried to answer everyone, too. And I'm not sure they all got home. And I'm not sure all of hers got to me, because we were at a lot of different places, and we didn't have a lot of mail calls sometimes. And when we did, boy, it was a great day. And sometimes I'd get letters that were... She sent after, in other words, the first letters hadn't reached me yet, but the second ones did. And it would be seesaw between letters. And then she said all my letters came back to her all cut up from the censors. I don't know what I was saying, but I don't think I was letting out any secrets. That's what they did. They read all of our letters before they went out to back home.
Yeah, take a razor blade to them. Did you have an idea before you were assigned? Did you have an idea of what kind of ship you were hoping to end up on?
No, I just followed whatever he sent me.
As it turns out, he would be sent into the teeth of a typhoon, an infamously destructive typhoon. We'll hear about that and other World War II Navy experiences with 95-year-old Joe Pinacura of Prunedale, California, when Hometown Heroes comes right back after this. Do you ever have those moments where you realize you've been settling for less than the best for far too long? Sometimes we just accept the status quo without looking around for better ways to do things. And I've got to tell you, when it comes to your money, I believe I found a better way with EECU. Take a look at myeecu.org and you'll see why. EECU is not a bank. It's a nonprofit credit union that's all about taking care of you, the member. That's one of the reasons EECU just keeps growing and growing. Close to 300,000 members now in 10 different California counties. Over 30,000 ATMs, free mobile banking. And what I really love is how EECU always goes above and beyond to serve the community. In 2013, the leadership and generosity of EECU helped establish Central Valley Honor Flight. More than 1,000 veterans now have gotten to see their memorials in Washington, D.C. for free. And that's just one example of the community involvement EECU takes oh so seriously. Pick up the phone and become a member today. 1-800-538-3328. That's 800-538-3328.
Proudly presented by Provident Payments, this is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and our visit with 95-year-old Joe Pinacura of Prunedale, California. I want to thank one of our listeners, Ray Bennett, who hears the program on KION out of Monterey and Salinas, for letting us know about Joe and his memorable experience as a teenager aboard the destroyer USS Craven.
The Craven was, I think, was kind of an unusual ship because it had 16 torpedoes on it. I mean, the ship with torpedoes and... big 5-inch cannon guns and a bunch of 20-millimeter guns. And it was only one stack. It was called a single stacker. USS Craven DD-382. Turned out to be, you know, pretty busy ship in the Pacific.
Well, let's hear about it. And how did they welcome you to the ship? Was there an adjustment period or something you had to get used to?
I got aboard ship. I was a seaman, you know. And what happens, they assign you to either the forecastle, the midship, or the fantan, the rear end of the ship. And you do whatever they tell you. Scrape paint, paint, scrape paint, paint. And then they assign you a battle station. And I was assigned to a 20-millimeter gun as a shooter. And I only weighed about 110 pounds at that time. And the first time I pulled the trigger on that thing, I couldn't control it. It was just boom, 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 boom. And I was supposed to be shooting at a target that some plane was pulling. Man, it's a lucky thing I didn't shoot that plane down. Because I'll tell you, I just could not control that gun. And the gunner's mate, who was in charge, says, "Get him off that gun before he kills somebody." And so they got me off of there, and they says, "Okay, you can load the shells onto the 20 millimeter. Well, they come in a great big canister, real heavy. I could hardly lift that canister. So you got to take the one that's emptied out. You got to take that off, and you got to put the other one on. And it jammed right away because I couldn't slam it into the 20 millimeter. And so they get him off that. He can't be a loader either. So then I was just in line bringing up ammunition. You know, they handed from one to another. But later on, there was an opportunity to work in the sick bay. One of the corpsmen transferred to a hospital ship. And I applied, and they gave me the job. So then they gave me a big book that says nursing on it. And next thing I know, I'm learning acetylsalicylic acid, which is an aspirin, and giving people stuff for constipation, and mouthwash. And then I got to doing closing cuts and small wounds, stuff like that. But we had a first-class pharmacist mate aboard and a chief petty officer who was a pharmacist mate. And then, of course, we had a doctor. So I got all the menial jobs. I had to, whatever they tell me to do, keep medical records, make sure supplies were available, and give shots, too. Yeah, kind of a good job.
And when you were heading out to sea, what was going through your mind? Were you wondering if you're ever going to see Shirley again, see your family again? Were you thinking you might not come back? What do you think was really on your mind at that time?
The only time I really, really was scared is when they assigned two destroyers to go all the way into the Japanese island harbors. Guam was one of them. I think Saipan was the other, Tinian. We went to a bunch of them, and we would go, the USS McCall, which was another destroyer, we would go right into their harbors and bombard the island. And the purpose of that was to have them actually open up their a barrage on that, because we had an aircraft that was taking pictures so they could find their, you know, where they're shooting from, because their planes from the carriers were going to go in next. And basically they said, you know, say your prayers because we're expendable. It was really a big surprise when we were bombarding the dickens out of them the very first time we did it, that they didn't fire back. And I could throw a baseball and hit the ground. And we did that island after island. We had a cruiser that was further out at sea that was also bombarding from there. And for all I know, there could have been a battleship behind him. But it was just a small unit that had that job. And that's when I started thinking, yep, I'm not going to be able to go home. And that was kind of sad. But then, thank you, Japanese, for not shooting at us. We wound up going back and escorting carriers, which was one of our primary jobs. And that was pretty good duty because when the pilots came back and they bounced off the carrier for one reason or another, we would pick up the pilot, you know, if he got out of the plane fast enough. Sometimes they didn't. And we picked up two or three pilots. And I, being in the sick bay, got to meet them because they brought them always down to the sick bay for examination. And then they would break open the liquor locker. And I had the key to the liquor locker. And the pilots would always say the same thing. Are you guys going to San Francisco? So that was a good part of the job. And then in battle stations, I would always be assigned with the medical equipment, either midship or aft, or up on a bridge, whatever they would put me. But, you know, it turns out that the Japanese kamikaze guys, they don't want destroyers. They want carriers. They could care less. We were really safe being a destroyer. The carriers were the ones that were in danger.
Well, and you guys were part of their line of defense, but I want to go back to what you shared there. When you and the McCall pulled into these harbors, you said close enough to throw a baseball, and you're trying to sniff out the Japanese guns. So for people who didn't get the picture there, basically you're the bait trying to expose the Japanese, and you're extremely vulnerable. Like you said, you're expendable, and you knew it.
Yeah, it was a surprise that they didn't fire back at us, because we figured, you know, we wouldn't be there very long, and we'd be damaged or sunk. And at Guam, another strange thing happened. There was someone flashing SOS at us from Guam. It turned out to be a guy named Tweed. And he was an American Navy guy who was hiding out from the Japanese for 2 years. And the McCall was closer to him doing the SOS, and they actually volunteered to get into a gig, you know, a small craft and a small boat, and go get him. They could have been going into a trap. We let's find out. But they did rescue him, and Tweed was rescued, and they even made a movie about that, No Man is an Island, later on. So I think it was George Tweed.
But you remember seeing those signals?
Oh yeah. We were almost side by side in the East Bay. Not too much room in the bay, you know. We're pretty close.
And when you said, you know, for general quarters, you'd be with medical equipment in different parts of the ship. So you're just standing by in case someone's wounded?
Right.
How often did you have to actually act on that?
When you're at general quarters every daylight, you know, you're dark at night, and when daylight comes, you're at general quarters, and when dusk comes, you're at general quarters again, because it could be submarines out there, could be, who knows, you just had to be ready for it.
And did you have some scenarios that you still remember where you did have to try to help somebody, care for guys who got hurt?
Not from being shot at, but from falling down and dropping ammunition. You drive a 5-inch shell on your foot, and man, you got a foot of trouble for the rest of your life. Yeah, and those kind of things happen. A couple times fellas fell overboard and we rescued them. And then, of course, just normal being having a cold, a common cold. They'd be down there in the sick bay, you know, just coughing, sneezing. But as far as enemy doing some damage on our ship, the only damage we got was from a typhoon, and that was a major damage.
Well, let's talk about that, because I've had a lot of guys share that typhoons were worse than the enemy when they went through them. Tell me what you experienced and what that felt like.
At one time during that typhoon, somehow I got on the bridge. I'm not sure how I got there. I can't remember how I got there, but I was there. And I was out on near a searchlight and the signal light. And I had to take some line and tie myself around that signal light. Otherwise, I'd have been gone. Because that ship went in every direction. It was like a rain, heavy rain. I recollect thinking it was a cork, a cork in the ocean, just being bounced every which way. And we lost 3 destroyers in that typhoon. They ended up calling it Admiral Halsey's typhoon. It turned out that he was supposed to meet General MacArthur somewhere, and he wanted to make that meeting, and he wasn't going to let a typhoon stand in his way. I think he made the wrong move, but in any case, our ship got busted up so badly that we limped back to Pearl Harbor at a slow speed. And then Pearl Harbor, we got a little welding done, and it wasn't enough. We had to go through the Panama Canal up to the Brooklyn Navy Yard and get the rest of the ship, you know, welded together.
And, you know, I've talked to some guys from those destroyers that went under, and they lost a lot of shipmates in that, and they were very fortunate to survive, and I know what happened to their ships, but it sounds like yours really went through the ringer too. Can you help us understand what it felt like? What kind of thoughts go through your mind? Because you have no control over any of this.
Well, it was unbelievable. At the time that it was happening, I was dunked in the water. I don't know how many times. That ship should have sunk too. You know, you go over 90 degrees, you normally don't come back. But the ocean's force throws you one way and throws you another way. It's like you're going to be doomed one minute and then rescued all by the ocean itself in the storm. It'd be a combination of lightning and thunder, and it was like a fantasy. And I think back sometimes, was I really there? Did it really happen to me? Yeah, just like unbelievable. We were really fortunate.
What do you do in a moment like that? Are you thinking about stuff back home? Are you praying? Are you just trying not to think about anything? What goes through your mind?
I think I was just watching. I didn't think when we were bombarding from the ports, I thought I was going to die. I didn't think that during the typhoon. I was just thinking, this is the darnest storm I've ever been in. It's just, it's horrible. And I never thought the ship would sink. I just thought we'd bounce around until the storm was over. And basically, that's what happened.
So what was it like coming back into New York after that?
Well, it was good for me because my sweetheart came from Chicago to Brooklyn, New York, and we got married in a courthouse. We got a license. We went over to the courthouse. They were having an automobile accident case, and we walked in the door, and the bailiff says, "What are you two doing here?" And we said, "We want to get married." And he tells the judge, "These two want to get married." And so the judge holds up the the court proceedings, and he questions us out loud in front of all these people, you know, because we were kids. We thought we were growing up, but we were kids. And when he found out that we actually were going together for over 2 years, or about 2 years, he says, "Okay, let's put you together." So we had to use the bailiff for a witness, and the reporter there was a witness. And as soon as he pronounced us man and wife, that whole court cheered. It's like we had an audience, you know. Hey, congratulations. And that was on June 15, 1945.
So you weren't quite 19, and how old was Shirley?
Her birthday was in November, so she was actually 17, turning 18.
So she had to have her parents' permission.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, and that was an easy thing for her to do because her parents were divorced, and she had to get both husband and, I mean, her father and mother for some reason.
And I'm sure people are trying to put themselves in your shoes. The war's not quite over yet. You don't know when it's going to be over. Why not just wait? Why was it so important for you to get married right then? What was the conversation you two had?
We just miss each other so badly. It was just so good to get together. It was like, never want to part again. Just love is strong, really strong. In fact, she stayed in Brooklyn while our ship, after it got repaired, we made a trip to Southampton, England, and back. So I saw her again when we returned. And then the next time we went to Plymouth, England, and unfortunately we didn't go back. We went to the Mediterranean, which was... The war was over by that time in the Mediterranean. And so we were like, our job was to go in every port and represent U.S. in a good way, you know, not drunken sailors. Mm-hmm. No, our job was to spread goodwill and get acquainted with people.
And, you know, back to this wedding, because I know a lot of guys, you know, I've had people on this show say, we wanted to get married because we didn't know what the future held. And others said, we didn't want to get married because we were afraid one of them's going to die. You guys get married as teenagers. Did anybody tell you that it wasn't going to last, or that you two were making a foolish decision or rushing to it or anything?
Yes, we heard that a lot from people. They say, you're too young to get married. You're too young to get married. I said, well, we're in love. What else can we do? We're just crazy about each other. So we're just going to disregard everybody's warnings and do it. And it turned out that they were all wrong, because we never even talked about a divorce. Never even talked about meeting the wrong person. It was like, it was a perfect marriage, 71 years. And then going together for 2 years, 73 years with that sweetheart. She was the girl. There's no doubt about it. I guess I was the guy.
No doubt about it, and that guy has some more World War II memories to share with us when we come back, including a couple of unique experiences with the enemy that altered his perspective, and what his trip to Washington, D.C. with Honor Flight Bay Area meant to him. Head over to hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page for photos and a short video of 95-year-old Joe Pinacura, and we'll be right back after this. I always love hearing from listeners, and so many of you tell me you listen to Hometown Heroes while you're on the road. Nobody spends more time on the road than our friends in the trucking business, and if that's your business, I'm sure you know about Central Valley Trailer Repair. If you don't, you really should. Conveniently located near California's major transportation arteries, CVTR has stockpiles of parts waiting for you in Fresno and in Stockton, with experienced service technicians ready to handle even the most difficult of repairs. Central Valley Trailer Repair is an authorized Great Dane sales, parts, and service center, and you can always find a huge inventory of new and used semi-trailers for sale too. Dry freight, refrigerated, flatbed, whatever you're looking for, CVTR has you covered. How about 24-hour emergency service? You bet. What can't CVTR help you with? That's a question I can't answer, so you'll have to ask them yourself at 1-800-877-8444. That's 1-800-877-8444. The website, that's simple, cvtr.com. For Central Valley Trailer Repair, and tell them you heard about them on Hometown Heroes.
honoring veterans from sea to shining sea. You're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler, brought to you by this local station and its sponsors, and presented everywhere, on the air and online, by Provident Payments, one of the fastest-growing payment consultants in America. Connect today at providentpayments.com.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and a fascinating visit today with 95-year-old Joe Pintacura. He told us about surviving Typhoon Cobra, or Halsey's Typhoon, as it's been called. Joe was aboard the destroyer USS Craven. Damage to the ship forced them to go back for repairs and eventually all the way to the Brooklyn Naval Yard, which allowed him to marry his sweetheart, Shirley.
So you get married in June, and as you said, your ship would eventually go across the Atlantic to England. But where were you on VJ Day? What was that like?
I remember, you know, the captain making an announcement and everybody just cheering. I think we were still in the Mediterranean. It was a joyful day. And then we were wondering, well, how soon can we get out of get discharged? Can we go home?
Never as soon as you want. And we touched on, you know, your bombardment of these islands, you guys being the bait that pulls in to try to get the guns to come out, going through the typhoon. Were there any other experiences aboard ship that are particularly memorable for you?
Yes, there's actually a couple. We shot down a Japanese plane, and for some reason they decided to pick up the pilot and the co-pilot. A bunch of the guys jumped in the ocean to save these two Japanese guys. The pilot actually drowned, but they still got his body. And the other guy, the co-pilot, they managed to save. Well, we had to bury the pilot at sea, and the co-pilot put him in the sick bay. So that was my job to take care of him. So they actually put him in my bunk, my sleeping bunk. And I had to sleep on the floor, and the idea was to get him eventually across to the carrier so they could question him. Well, here's the part that you won't believe. I had to make all these motions when he's talking about eating, going to the bathroom, you know, giving them a shot, taking care of them. I had the doctor and the chief pharmacist mate and the first class pharmacist mate there to help, but I got all the menial jobs. I had to, you know, take them to the bathroom and stuff like that, feed them. And I had to make all these motions because I figured he couldn't even speak English. And we had a guy on our ship. The oldest guy that was on our ship was a guy that had a job as a boilermaker. He was the one that did a lot of the welding when we hit the typhoon and stuff. And I didn't get to see him a whole lot. And he was kind of a crabby guy. The time I did see me, when he came to the sick bay, it was like, you know, don't talk to me. So he's coming to the sick bay to get some treatment. And he looks at this Japanese guy and he says, "I know you. You and I got drunk together in San Francisco." Honest, and I thought, this is a bunch of baloney, you know, I mean, no way. And the guy starts talking English to him. And then I met at the guy, the Japanese guy, because I said, "You son of a gun, you pretended you couldn't speak English, and you knew everything that everybody's saying around here." And it turns out he was an old-time, I mean, he'd been in the Air Force like maybe 15, 20 years, and been to America many times. And so these guys are reminiscing about San Francisco. And the next thing you know, I'm joining the conversation because I'm taking care of him. He's telling me about his family and his kids and stuff, and we kind of became friends. So that memory stayed with me, that here I've got an enemy who's kind of a friend now. And when we were in the Mediterranean, I had to take some patients to the hospital there, and I called for a driver, a car. And a car pulls up, and a guy gets out of the car, and he's wearing a PW, prisoner of war jacket. He's a German, speaks English. And now I'm hopping in a car with a German enemy. And then I find out he's got a family. He's talking all about his family because I was with him the whole day. So now I got this German friend and I got this Japanese friend. Why the heck did we go to war?
Sounds like that really altered your perspective a little.
Oh, God, yeah. Now when I see like I say, I worked in the school district for 21 years. And there's exchange students. And when I see Japanese exchange students, you know, I can't help but welcome them with open arms. And the Germans, Italians, all exchange students, I make an extra effort to welcome them. Because then I had a different outlook about the war. It was like they had to go, we had to go, and why?
And the Japanese co-pilot on your ship, Do you happen to remember his name?
No, I was just a kid. I should have got more information. I should have just been smart enough to, would have that for memories, but I didn't. Everything was just kind of speeding along in those days.
I don't know if you have some memories of this, or I'm just asking you to speculate, but have you ever thought about what it must have been like for your mother to have four boys in the service?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, you bet. Because, there was another family that lost five children, the Sullivan brothers. They all went on one ship, and that ship got sunk. And that was a big news everywhere. And it made, particularly in my case, with the three older brothers, but one was in below the equator, the other one was in the States, and one was on a carrier. He was on the Enterprise. He was a radio man and gunner. He saw quite a bit of action because those guys had to, fly and drop bombs.
You're talking about Roy?
Yeah.
So he was on SBDs?
He was on the Enterprise carrier, and he's on a plane they call the Avenger.
A TBF.
Yeah. With a big belly. And they, in fact, when we got out of that typhoon and we went to Pearl Harbor, the Enterprise was there. So I went over to visit them. And would you know, that was on a day they were taking off for a trial bombing mission. They were carrying two 500-pound bombs, and they were aiming at a target that was being towed by a ship in the ocean. And the radio man and gunner, my brother was a radio man and gunner, but they had a turret gunner. And the turret gunner said, if he wants to go up with you, I won't be doing anything. And if it's okay with the pilot, he can take my place. And the pilot says, yeah, you can go. And so I went up with him on that practice runs. And, man, that was a real treat because they did a lot of practice dives before they dropped the bombs. And they would, you're up there in that plane that suddenly gets in formation. You see all these other planes in line. Then they peel off one at a time. I was in heaven. It was great. And my brother Roy was old hat because he did it so many times.
What a thrill ride. Did you have guys either from your ship or that you had gotten to know before or during the war that didn't come home from the war the way you and your brothers got to?
We lost one guy while he was sitting on a depth charge while we were in some rough sea. I don't know. But the ship made a quick turn and we lost him and he drowned. It was a terrible way to... We went back to try to find him. We just couldn't find him. But other than that, most of those guys on that ship died after they came home, either from illness or old age. But we had a lot of reunions, and it was nice to see most of those guys. We had one guy who was so angry at the Japanese that every reunion he would say, "How many of you guys have bought Japanese cars? What's wrong with you? Why did you buy Japanese cars? There are enemies in the war. You're still our enemies." Of course, we let him rattle on because we're all friends now. No more enemies.
You mentioned working for the school district, North Monterey County, for a couple decades. You've also been back to do presentations. You were just showing me some of the PowerPoint you prepared for students there. And on one of the pictures, I saw an honor flight jacket. So you got to go back to Washington, D.C.
Yes.
And see that National World War II Memorial. What was that like for you? What was that experience all about?
Well, that was a real treat. Not only just for me, but I went with about 30 guys. All World War II guys, and they're all, most of them were either my age or there was even a couple older. And just to be together with them, even if we didn't go anywhere, was a real honor and treat. But when we got to Washington, and we got to see, the raising of the flag at Iwo Jima, it brought back memories that of what our mostly Army and Marines went through. Being on a ship, if you're going to die, you're going to die clean. Those guys, they really had it tough. And it was great that we all could be together and visit all these places in Washington, D.C. We had a motorcycle escort. We were on buses that were zooming through Washington. It was a special treat. It went all too fast because it was just one weekend. And my son Gary, who was a Vietnam veteran, by the way, was my escort, you might say. He's the one that pushed me around in the wheelchair all the time. They won't let you walk. They make sure you can survive the trip. And so he's pushing me constantly in a wheelchair here, there, and everywhere. And he was also helping when the buses got to each place, he would get out and help, line up the wheelchairs. He really enjoyed it.
And I'm just curious for you, because at that World War II memorial, you know, it's honoring you and your brothers and 16 million Americans who served and came home, but also 406,000 plus who didn't come home. And they have those gold stars there to represent that giant number. What kinds of thoughts or memories or emotions were going through your mind when you were there at the National World War II Memorial?
You know, I have that in my PowerPoint presentation because I'm one of these kids that mostly these seniors and juniors in high school to realize that kids their age were not much older than them were dying. There's 400,000 plus kids. And I tell them that I'm 95 years old. I got to enjoy all these years from 1946 to now. Had a family. And all those kids, all those crosses you see, they didn't have that. They lost it. And they did it for all of us. And so, you know, I want them to, you know, to feel it. Because it's pretty tough. Yeah, all over the world, they got those graveyards.
I don't think anybody can say it any better than you just did. And if there's anything else that's important to you to share, I don't want to leave anything out. But I don't want to forget to say thank you. Thank you for serving our country. Thank you for telling us about it and for telling young people to keep this history alive, as you just shared. Is there anything else that I didn't bring up that you think is important for us to know?
I closed my presentation with them, showing them some trees and roses and flowers and beautiful stuff. And I tell them now, in World War II, we had definite enemies to fight. But the world, the whole globe was still here. But if you guys don't fight, there won't be any world. There won't be any globe in the sky. There won't be any planet there. Much bigger, tougher job than World War II was.
And I know, you know, we talked about Shirley. You mentioned the 71 years before you lost her. Whenever I meet someone who's been married that long, I like to ask them what their secret was. What do you think was the key to the longevity of your marriage?
Well, you know, there were so many sayings about that. One of them that's popular that I think was pretty good, that kind of brings it to the point, is that I made all the important decisions, and she told me what was important.
Yep, I think there are a lot of spouses, one way or the other, nodding in agreement with that right now. And, you know, you've got, if I remember this right, 4 kids and 8 grandkids and 11 great-grandkids and even a great-great-grandchild now, none of whom would be here if you didn't come home from World War II. When you think about all this life that you've led, 95 years, what would you say you're most proud of?
Well, that marriage of mine and my Shirley, again, the secret to that marriage was when I wanted her to be my wife, I did everything I could to show her my best side. And then after we got married and started to get into some heavy-duty financial problems, it dawned on me that, hey, I was starting to lose that. I still want her to be in my life. And so I went back to what I used to do in the beginning. I started opening car doors for her. I kept helping her with her seatbelt, help her find a chair. You just got to never quit courting. And as long as you court her, she'll love you. And I'm proud of that. And I teach my kids to do that. And I see my kids doing that. And again, stay away from dope, stay away from alcoholism. Just lead a clean life and be responsible, be positive. There's going to be ups and downs, but your job is to make her happy and your kids happy and yourself happy all your life. It's going to be tough, but you can do it.
And I realize there's one thing I didn't ask you about. So, you know, you mentioned her coming up to Brooklyn to get married when you came in. But what about when you came home after that, when you got to see her again and now the war is over and you can finally start your life together? Where was that and what was that moment like?
It was Chicago, Illinois. When I came home and we did like you see in the movies, we just rushed at each other, we hugged each other, we kissed, we couldn't break away. My family was there behind me because she went actually to my mother's house, my mother and father's house, and I came right from the train station there. I just came into the front hall and then gone into the front room of the house where everybody's waiting. And just the two of us in that front hall, just we couldn't break away. Everybody was pounding on the door. Come on, we want to see you too. And no way. We it just was, I think we're there for like over an hour. And they were saying, come on, come on, come on. We want to see you too. Oh, yeah, we're just so So happy.
Well, and I asked you what you're most proud of, so that's kind of looking back. But I also want to ask you a forward-looking question. Is there anything that hasn't happened in your 95 years or you haven't done that you're still looking forward to or you'd still like to see come to pass?
Well, I'm enjoying watching all these grandkids grow up and their families grow up and the excitement in each of their lives. It's good for me to be part of it, still here, being able to help when I can. And also to just enjoying what's all family. It's just marvelous. When they have a little few spats and a few problems, sometimes they'll come and ask me what my feelings are about it, and I try to give them the best advice. But they all seem to be getting through life not too bad. So I must be doing something good. Just wish my honey was here to enjoy the conversation with you. When I lost her, I thought I'd be right behind. I thought I'd go too, because without her, I just lost everything. But the kids pulled me through. All my kids come to the rescue, my grandkids. So I'm still here, plugging away.
Joe Pintacura, he'll celebrate birthday number 96 next month in Prunedale, California. That's all the time we have on today's program, but thanks so much for listening. I'm Paul Leffler, reminding you again that freedom is not free.
To let Paul know about a veteran in your life, visit hometownheroesradio.com and click on Suggest a Veteran. Today's program has been brought to you by Provident Payments. Give your business the edge only their personalized service can deliver at providentpayments.com.